This is June 7th, 1984, and this is Dave Crippen at the Design History Project at the Henry Ford Museum. And today we're having a chat with William Bill Boyer, longtime Ford design executive, who has agreed to chat about his long career in design and styling at Ford. Bill, our format is that we try to make the mic as unobtrusive as possible and just ask you to begin at the beginning and give us a detailed discussion of your career in styling at Ford and elsewhere.
How close to this mic do you have to be? Is this okay? Is the recording level, let's see, recording level okay from here? Just a little bit. I'm rather soft-spoken, so it's your view meter say it's okay.
That's okay.
All right. Well, I suppose in order to start at the beginning, I think you probably I'd probably have to start with the decision to get into design. I went from high school into World War II in naval aviation. After the war, I decided that I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer. Attended the University of Maryland since I was a Washington, D.C., Bethesda, Maryland type of guy. And I discovered that in my second year of engineering, I had a lot of drawings of boats and airplanes and et cetera, and the dividers between my subjects, and decided that, you know, as a mathematician, I'd make an excellent truck driver. So I had 3 years of GI Bill left, went to Pratt Institute and...
In Brooklyn,
right.
Well-known design.
Yeah, very, very well-known. The reputation of the school was excellent. And there were thousands of GIs trying to get into it, so I felt very fortunate that I was in there. You mentioned Ken Spencer. He was in the class ahead of me, but we knew one another at Pratt, along with some of the other people. And I ended up with a scholarship to General Motors, so I ended up with 2 years in the experimental studio at GM. Some of that time was actually spent in one of Mr. Earl's Harley Earl's design studios. And then a gentleman by the name of Frank Hershey called me and invited me to come over to Ford and work on a new sports car that they were going to
Was that the initial contact?
That was the initial contact, yes.
Any reason why Frank would single you out? Or?
I had known Frank through a church contact, and he had left Packard as chief designer, come to Ford, and we were just acquainted. Mm-hmm. And he was acquainted with my work, and he knew I wasn't all that enthusiastic about the styling at General Motors, you know, the personnel relations.
Before we get into Ford, can you tell us a bit about your work with in the Earl studio at GM?
I basically got into the experimental end of it with a gentleman whose studio I was in named Bill Lang. Mm-hmm. Bill Lang at GM. Then after some work on the manuals for the XP-8, the LeSabre, Mr. Earl's LeSabre, I was then transferred into the Mr. Earl's B studio, where we did what I think was about the 52 Olds OB body, the Olds Buick body we were working on. At the time Frank called me, and needless to say, I jumped at the opportunity to go to Ford and work on a sports car.
Now, why was that? What was the situation in the styling department at GM that made you available?
Well, it was a very autocratic organization.
Under Mr. Earl?
Under Mr. Earl. And I was just a very low-profile kind of guy, and they were rooting, tooting, shooting high living kinds, and I just elected to opt out of that organization and come to Ford, which was sort of like a breath of fresh air. It was like coming to a big family, mm-hmm. which I enjoyed much more. Never regretted the decision, regardless of the GM bonuses. So I arrived over here in 1952, March of 1952, working in what is now Triple E building, where the styling section was located. And Frank Hershey brought me in, introduced me to Jean Bourdonnais, who was the head of the design operation in the styling section under Charlie Waterhouse, mm-hmm. who was the chief engineer at that time. Mm-hmm. And I would work immediately for Frank Hershey and the late Damon Woods, who was in charge of Body Development Studio.
Damon had come from, Mr. Woods had come from where?
I'm not sure where Damon came from. He was a University of Michigan graduate. I know he worked at Curtis Wright during World War II. He wasn't in the service during World War II. I think he had an exemption because he was working for Curtis Wright Corporation in engineering. I know he related some incidents of working on the canopies of the aircraft at that Curtis Wright.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know just what his history was in coming to Ford, whether he was acquainted with some of the whiz kids that came out of the
I think he may have come over with Grissinger.
Grissinger.
Grissinger,
yes. Uh-huh. Could have been.
Yes.
Could have been.
No,
I think Damon was here prior to Buzz Grissinger. Buzz Grissinger and Reese Miller had a design studio in town,
mm-hmm.
and I guess I'm just not sure of the history, the sequence, the chronological sequence there. But I was working for Damon until he went to Europe as VP over there, design VP, and lost his life in an untimely accident here on the expressway.
What sort of a man was he to work for?
Damon was a. I really respected Damon tremendously. He was a very creative individual, and always had things very clearly in focus. Very, very nice person, and very dedicated to his craft. I thought he was certainly a loss to the industry when Damon lost his life. But I worked for Damon in the Body Development Studio, and the first full program I was on was the 1955 Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, Frank Hershey was trying to interest the Ford management with Jean Bourdonnais in responding to the Corvette series that it was being introduced in 1954 by General Motors Chevrolet. And we had done a couple of abortive attempts at trying to get this off the ground, and it was with some effort on their part that finally the management agreed, yes, we do need a style leader that in the sports car area, because virtually all sports cars were European at that time, Jag XK120 and the Austin Healey and the Maseratis. Everything in this country was imported in terms of sports cars. And our car, we wanted more volume than could be entertained by a pure sports car. So we agreed that ours should probably have roll-up windows and a top that would operate more efficiently than most of them had at that time.
I remember the MG.
Yeah, right, the MG of that era. And even the Corvette, I had a strange little oriental top with.
That's right.
It was a funny little car built of fiberglass. And I can recall Henry Greepy, the chief engineer at that time, insisting that our sports car was going to be in steel with roll-up windows and done properly, or we weren't going to do it at all.
Who was that again?
Henry Greepy. Henry Greepy.
Chief engineering.
Yeah, he was the... guess he was the chief body engineer. Chief body engineer. I think he was responsible for body.
In those days, if we can pause for a moment, can you give us sort of a personal summary of what design process was in the early 50s? In other words, it's probably a little bit different than it is today. Weren't you more oriented toward working with the engineer, body engineers?
Not really. Although we were under engineering, we've come kind of a full orbit here.
Circle,
yeah. Yeah. The latest contraction of the industry, that painful contraction, has resulted in us being literally back under engineering with no longer Jean Bordenay as a vice president. That's essentially the way we started out under Charlie Waterhouse, under engineering. We've come full circle. But the design center is much bigger than the styling section was in those days because of the proliferation of car lines, you know, everything's on a greater magnitude. But surprisingly enough, until we started introducing, and which is really hasn't been introduced yet functionally into the design center, with until the introduction of the computer-aided design, the graphics tubes and that kind of operation, the actual process didn't change appreciably. As a matter of fact, when I was writing workload letters for Jack Telnack and trying to justify our position and you know, relate workload to personnel and trying to cover our tails over there in the design center where things are being cut back so bad, I noted that, you know, one of the great sculptors like Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci could come right up and pick up a clay modeling tool and know just what he was doing, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was that, it was almost a medieval guild type of operation. And there's still a lot of design judgment and personal effort that goes into it. Most of the effort to date in computer-aided design is downstream of the creative process in the design center. The surfaces are picked up by scanners and it's digitized and it goes to body engineering, is disseminated out through the system. But the actual sketching, the conceptual sketching, the visualization of the form and the modeling hasn't changed appreciably. Only now are we getting programs in house where designers are going to start to be trained to use and design directly on the graphics tubes. So it'll really be the next generation for myself that really applies that in depth. So to answer your original question, virtually no change over many years. We should probably have moved faster. There were changes regarding more sophisticated recording equipment, the scanners and milling of properties, clay models and things like that, that speeded up the process to some degree, but the basics were essentially untouched in the creative process.
Well, while I'd like very much to take the opportunity to ask you if you will go through step by step the sports car program, who was involved, who did what, who was responsible for the original concept, the idea, then the concept, and then the design. If you could take us through and as you remember it, the various your various colleagues, what they did, and so forth, who you worked for, and that sort of thing.
Because
I think the story's been told two or three times, but I think this is a great opportunity for to get your full story on that project that came up with the Thunderbird eventually.
Okay, I'll see how good my recall is. In late 52. We were doing some package work in 3/8 on the Ford sports car, At that time, our package work was done on 3/8 scale because the package department at that time consisted of two people in the Ford studio, John Zimmerly, the late John Zimmerly, and Everett David, still extant up in Anchor Bay, somewhere up in that area. The original concept was that we wanted a sports car that had some of the nuances of the current Ford vehicles that would have rub-off value in the merchandising of the vehicles. The first shot came back from engineering that they would, oh yeah, they would cut down the car and shorten the wheelbase, but the engine wouldn't be moved back, and that just didn't seem suitable. It really wouldn't have the handling and the balance that you would desire in a car that allegedly competed with the Europeans, although not in reality. The second phase of this came some months later in early 53, was that yes, the engineering fraternity had agreed that, you know, we ought to do the thing right, and I've mentioned Mr. Grebe's views on that. And we got a very nice package with the engine moved back, two-passenger with the occupants slightly aft of amidships, which gave us a long hood, short deck kind of proportion, very sporty concept, quite a locale for those days, and would set the trend in the sporty look for many years to come, including the Mustang, which evolved some years later. at that time, there was myself in the studio. I'm just trying to recall the other designers. I was more or less the senior guy in the studio because I had all of 3 years in the business. Worked for Damon, who was the section supervisor. Frank Hershey was chief stylist for Ford at that time. Gene Bourdonnais was chief stylist for Lincoln Mercury, both working for Charlie Waterhouse. I can recall a young gentleman by the name of Dick Sampson that was in the studio for a while at that time. The major portion of the car sketching that was done was by Dick and myself. In those days, the body development studio was responsible for the initial body sheet metal. And then as the car evolved, the studio, the Ford studio, would take it over and do the ornamentation of wheel covers, the finessing of the vehicle. Interestingly enough, the 55 sports car was done as an interior-exterior model. The interior was modeled right in the exterior buck. And that was a technique that had never been used before, because when the top was down, we wanted the interior and the exterior to relate properly and not have some of the glitches that you run into in the European cars where things don't look properly coordinated, don't have a continuity of surface. So we started on the body and got it well along, and then ran into the usual problems of, hey, this is going to be a very low-volume car. We can't afford all the tooling for the things that you guys are dreaming of. Let's get realistic, you know. Same bumper bar, front and rear. Let's plagiarize the 55 Ford with its finials and its headlamps and taillights, and all of which was very familiar because I had been working on that program. As a matter of fact, I think the Ford at 50 book, not that one, I think it's Ford at 50. There's a picture of me taken by Philip Halsman, who did the photography of on the full-size board working on the 55 Ford.
Yes.
So it was very easy to translate that stuff into the sports car, minimize the tooling cost, and get it into an affordable range where the car could lunch off the major Ford vehicle, Ford line of cars and a little line down at the end of the Rouge plant and make economic sense, as long as you, at least it was sufficient that you could write it off for advertising and marketing expense without having to undergo the, you know, the surveillance of the bean counters,
right.
Which in their minds every project had to pay out in a certain number of months or years, or it was a no-go situation. So I think the most traumatic experiences were trying to preserve the design intent of the car with those constraints. And also we had a highly politically charged environment about that time. George Walker had come in and had Joe Orris and Elwood Engel in the studios. They were the design consultants, since we didn't have a huge nor respected styling department at that time. They were always looking for somebody else to bless this
mm-hmm.
operation.
Mm-hmm.
And it led to some confrontations between the consultants and the studios. The consultants came in and helped, and many times presented the cars and took credit for what the styling guys were had really evolved, and the work they had done was not acknowledged. So we had a bit of a frenzy there for a while, until George Walker came in as vice president, which put an end to all of that. He could then legitimately say, I am king in the hill, and you guys do what I say. But it wasn't all-out war. It was just a tension that was always existent between a typical consultant, in-house design team kind of thing. And also the... well, I can't say that there weren't some ruffled feathers, because they had taken the 55 Bird and presented it to management and said, look, what we did, isn't it great? And
Orris and Engel?
This was George Walker and Joe Orris, basically.
Yeah.
Engel was on Lincoln Mercury at the time. So there were those, you know, those are the little political aspects you never really hear about, but that exist in any typical management organization. But I later worked for Joe and George and had a, you know, a great time, and we were all great friends. It was I'm just trying to think, as the vehicle evolved, there were others that got involved in the design of the vehicle. When it went into the Ford studio, Dave Ash, I remember in particular, we had an engine clearance problem to the top of the carburetor because of locale, and Dave came up with a very neat power dome concept, which kind of established the identity of that bird, on the hood, which hadn't existed before. As a matter of fact, I was talking to Lois Imager the other day, the Classic Thunderbird Car Club, because they want me to give a little talk at their national meeting here in July.
Yeah.
And she has one of those birds without the power dome, one of the early prototype hoods without the power dome, because it was a late addition by Ford Studio after the car had pretty much been processed. A lot of the ornamentation basically was done by the guys in Ford Studio. The name was given to the bird by Alden Giberson, Gibb as we called him.
Gibb Giberson.
Gibb, yeah. Gibb was the one that came up with the Thunderbird name and was given a beautiful suit of clothes by Mr. Crusoe, which was the incentive to come up with the name.
Something about his interest in Arizona Indian lore.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, he was familiar with this and just thought that it would make a great name for the car, and it ended up being selected.
Were there other names in consideration? Do you remember?
Oh, yeah, there were hundreds of names.
What were some of the finalists?
Gosh, I can't... I'm afraid I... One of them specifically, that Mr. Crusoe, as I recall, was interested in, was Savile. Savile Row in London, street with the tailors and the... Yeah,
yeah.
Right. Of course, he was familiar with Savile Row, and that had connotations of luxury and, and prestige to him, and it sort of said nothing to us, since...
Right.
We bought our clothes off the plain pipe racks at Robert Hall and Sears, you know.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah,
everybody did. That's the only one that I remember. One of the ones that we didn't use and did come into prominence later was Cougar.
Right.
Cougar.
That was the code name for the Mustang, as I recall.
I don't know whether it was or not, to tell you the truth. The Mustang, as I recall, it was called Special Falcon.
Yeah,
very early on. As a matter of fact, the Falcon, the first Falcon was called XK Thunderbird. Yeah. And that was the code for Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
Joris called me back, I guess that was 1957. We didn't get Friday off after Thanksgiving in those days. And I was going to take off Friday and go back home to see my folks for Thanksgiving. Joe called me and said, "No, you're not. You're going to be in here on Friday. We've got a new small car to start, and it's got to start now." So, and that was the Falcon, which was codenamed XK Thunderbird. And I was interested to find out that the first Thunderbird that was the first Falcon that was produced in Australia was called XK Falcon, because the XK, they don't have a model year designation, since they're not introduced in an annual manner. They had picked up the XK off the Thunderbird drawings, of which they had received from the U.S. to do modifications to the original Falcon that was being manufactured in Australia. I think that was probably 1962. They picked up the 60 Falcon tooling, modified it for Australia, and put it in position. And the XK Falcon started the original series in Australia, and it went on and on and on, the X series, and then it started over with a new Falcon called the XA, the XB, XE, the XD.
Mm-hmm.
The XD, I happened to be chief designer for Australia, so I got back in the Falcon business there for a while. But that's...
Louis Crusoe was chief of what we now call North American Automobile Operations.
Yeah, at that time he was vice president and general manager, I think he was called, of Ford Division, which is now really NAO and embraces the whole operation with Lincoln Mercury.
Was it one of, since you come from GM and presumably the was familiar with the Corvette project before and after, was it pretty much his... idea that a sport car should be?
I wasn't privy to that kind of information in those days. I was just a little guy in the corner on the board.
Yeah.
The only thing that I do know is that George Walker and Lou Crusoe were at the Paris Auto Show, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And George knew of our efforts to get a sports car early on, before he came into the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Crusoe mentioned at the Paris Auto Show that, boy, we ought to have something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was alleged that George went and called Hershey or somebody back here and said, hey, you know that project, get it going, because I've just told Crusoe that we've got one in
the works.
And by God, there better be a clay model going when I get back, you know.
That's too good of a story to...
I heard this from Frank and various people, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it sounds like George Walker. He was the ultimate politician.
And Frank Hershey would have been the person he had...
I would think so, because he was the chief stylist of the Ford studio.
Mm-hmm.
And Is that an organization chart of those days you've got
yeah,
there?
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I guess you're probably...
Well, this is John Nader's, and it looks as if Hershey...
Oh, yeah, I see. Mm-hmm.
And Gordon
mm-hmm.
A. are here
mm-hmm.
with...
Yeah, Frank was Ford's studio of chief stylist, and Gene Gordon A. was a Lincoln Mercury chief at that
right.
time, under at Charlie Waterhouse, as
yeah,
I recall.
Right. So Waterhouse appears to be the
yeah.
The chief under Walker. Walker hadn't quite come in yet.
No, Walker came in back. You see, that's when we broke away from engineering and became an entity of our own.
Right.
And Walker was a VP.
Right.
Reporting to Lou Crusoe.
Yeah.
It was the first time that engineering and design were dissociated as far as the organization chart goes.
So apparently Waterhouse was the chief, and Hershey and Bordenay were under
mm-hmm. him. Yeah, they each had the Lincoln Mercury and the Ford.
Right.
Because actually it was Charlie Waterhouse that hired myself in 52.
Yeah.
And but it is a good story, and it sounds very plausible.
Mm-hmm.
But although, as I say, I wasn't really privy to that level of conversation at that time. The product planning people that I recall at that time, one of the chief planners was Chase Morrissey.
Mm-hmm.
Another planner was Bill Grimes, about that era. The, the secretary of the styling committee was Eric Lang, who was an engineer and really recorded the minutes and kept track of the meeting results. Those days, and that was in probably 53. Then in 1973, I went to Australia, and there was Eric Lang as chief engineer at Ford Australia. So we worked 20 years later together, and myself as chief designer, him as chief engineer. And let's see if I can remember some more of the planners about that day. As a matter of fact, shortly after that, I met Don Peterson.
Mm.
Don Peterson was, I guess it was on a 55 Ford about that time, that Don Peterson came back from his stint in the Marines, I think, and was product planning manager, I think, for Ford Division.
Mm-hmm.
I think he still had Marine greens and a brush haircut at that time. So I have that.
Tom Case came along a little bit later.
Tom Case was there as product planning manager for the Thunderbird car line.
Yeah.
The other guys, Chase Morrissey, Bill Grimes, and Peterson were up the ladder a little further in more executive positions. But Tom Case is the guy I worked directly with.
Mm-hmm.
As the product planner in charge of the product.
So there you are. You've got a mandate. You've from the top. You've got Chase Morrissey, and you've got the body engineers. And you've got the design.
Once we had the cost situation well in hand, we had solved those problems. The next thing that occurred was the instrument panel and the cluster in the little bird that had been modeled in the full-size Buck, likewise was much too expensive to tool on a low-volume car. So that got cast aside, that instrument cluster in particular, and we reverted to using the 55 Ford cluster, which had the little turn signal blinker nacelles on the side and the
right.
trepan skull and the see-through top and the behind the speedometer. We virtually picked up the instrumentation intact and utilized a lot of it, except that we integrated into a unique panel for the bird with an engine-turned substrate or ornamental panel.
Your original design for the panel was cast aside.
Well, in a sense it was for that year, for 55.
Yeah.
It was so well liked that what happened was the cluster was tooled for the 56 Ford, which was a big domed, almost an orchestra shell type of, with the round gauges in it. It got tooled in a high volume Ford where they could utilize it. Then, because it was then existent, we picked it up on the 57 Bird. Because it had been funded and created in sort of a roundabout manner. So at the time we facelifted the 56, went to 57, there was the, our original cluster. So we put it in a car and cobbled it into the panel and blended it all in with the crash pad.
Worked very well.
Yeah, it worked, a very successful remarriage, I guess, because of its origin in the Bird and its utilization 2 years later.
So this is in 53 you're working on the original design.
Yeah, right, right. As a matter of fact, interestingly enough, one of the first cars that we put the deep dish steering wheel and a crash pad on the instrument panel was the 56 Bird. Yeah. We actually had the 56 Bird had a ribbed, localized panel ahead of the passenger. And the deep dish steering wheel with its collapsible column.
And which was popularly supposed to be able to absorb with its...
the chest loads, the without chest load. The penetration of the column.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And seat belts. You know, a lot of work was done on those early 50s cars in safety, and nobody much acknowledged it in those days. There were some rather snide commentary about Ford selling safety and Chevy selling cars, you know. And Chevy came out with their V8 and all kinds of things, so they got their macho image, and we were sort of being the good guy, selling safety and going right down the tube. Bad news in 56, yeah.
But you were vindicated.
Oh, and ultimately, you know, a couple of decades hence. So that was pretty much the team that evolved the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And it was very limited in its offerings as far as accessories go, and as far as colors go, you know, there was white and red and turquoise and black. I think that was it for the first introduction. There was very few colors. And
was it at the design executive level, was it an instant hit in terms of, was it accepted right away, or did you have some problems getting it accepted?
Well, it was accepted at the level that it counted, which was Lou Crusoe in those days. It's a bit of a dichotomy. You can get these projects, you know, off the ground, and if they're not guaranteed success, you have a hard time getting participation, because anything that doesn't have a guaranteed reception that is positive has an onus of, boy, let's run away from that one. I don't want to be associated with it. So there was a mixed feeling there, I think. And at the time, you know, myself, I just happened to be there and was given the assignment to work on the car, and was too young to recognize the political danger and jeopardy we were all in working on such a car. So it was, you know, it was ignorance is bliss kind of thing.
Were you caught up in that sports car mystique of the early 50s? Did you find it congenial and working in this tradition?
Oh, yes. I think we were all trying to break away from the Ford Mercury four-door sedan kind of idiom that we were working in, and we had. We weren't that far past the World War II era, where anything you could pump out was acceptable, but we were just beginning to get into an era where people were just replacing the old worn-out wartime cars, and were beginning to look for a little pizzazz and some excitement. And I think probably, you know, management recognized the fact that there was a desire that more imports were going to be brought in. And
the European sport car was just beginning to come into its post-war orbit, wasn't it?
Right, right.
And there were being more and more were being imported.
Yes, right. As a matter of fact, one of the popular cars of the day was the Nash Healey, which was a Nash,
oh, yeah.
Nash and Healey of Great Britain cooperative effort. Jag FK-120 and the
couple battalion.
Yes, the the legendary Cisitalia, you know, which was the first one that put the hood lower than the fender line, was a very desirable thing at that time. And of course the Ferraris and things. Mr. Ford had, as I recall, the cars that we used as our bogies in the development of the program, there was a black Ferrari that Mr. Ford had over
Ford
the test
second.
Track. Yes, Henry Ford the second had. There were some Jag XK-120s, most of which were owned by doctors and Grosse Pointe and things. That they're a bit too rich for the common man's blood at that time. We rented those, you know, brought them in and used them as stalking horses for our efforts to do something that was not as sporty as that, a little more traditional and yet more suited to the American market. A few more conveniences. So that those car evolved out of the European ambiance that they had into something that was more sporty than sports car, and something that we could evolve from Detroit Iron, the American hardware, without getting too exotic. Let's see, is there anything else about it that I guess I could interject one thing. We did try and introduce several things that never happened on the car. We tried to put road lamps in the circular guards that were on the front bumper. We did get the exhaust stacks coming out through the rear bumper guards. Did that for several years. We did try to do some competition windscreens for the vehicle. Never happened. The efforts to get the full wrap windshield were greater than a desire for the competition windscreens. But I guess it's those sketches in Langworth's book there. Some of the original sketches when the program was nearing its end. I still have those sketches at home. They have a couple of sketches with the competition windscreens,
right.
Here and the road lamps, and that one sketch.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That shows, it's interesting in the fact that we evolved things that were never became part of the program, which is typical of, you know, the design process.
Mm-hmm.
You evaluate which options are going to sell and will pay out according to the bean counters guidelines, or which will not fly and will not get approved, et cetera, et cetera.
The car itself was an instant success, wasn't it?
Yeah, it became a legend in its own time. I drove one back. Tom Case loaned me a little convertible. I drove back home in, let's see, I guess it was the fall of 55.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I had never had a honeymoon, and so I took her back home to visit my folks and down to Maryland. We went through Skyline Drive and down into Virginia and Maryland and that area.
You were driving one of the early Thunderbirds.
Yeah, it was a black Thunderbird convertible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it would... People would snap their heads around to look at it, but they didn't know what it was at that time.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't gotten the exposure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the cleanliness and the simplicity of the design probably carried the car. I still have a ad for the car from a Saturday Evening Post of October 54.
Mm.
And it has uh, it has the checkmark molding, like the 55 Ford. And our enthusiastic management and marketing people thought this great checkmark swash molding would be just great for our pure, pristine little sports car, and said it, yes, it would go on the high series over our dead bodies kind of thing. And it actually got out into the advertising copy. Several magazines, it was published.
There was a prototype also.
Yes, as a matter of fact, Mr. Crusoe drove it around for quite some time. And
it was one of his ideas, wasn't it? Or was, at least he supported it.
He supported it. It actually evolved off the Mystere show car, which I did in 54.
Yeah. I want to ask you about that a little bit later.
Yeah, the Mystere show car was done in 54, but we used a lot of stuff off of it for the 57 Ford. So the use of the car in the Detroit Auto Show was delayed a year, because some of the cues that were used on 57 Ford, the swash molding and the fins and things, related too much to the production car to expose at that early date. And
how were you able to disabuse management of the check mark?
Well, I think Frank Hershey and Gene probably just talked them out of them.
How were you able to disabuse management of the check mark?
Well, I think Frank Hershey and Gene probably just talked them out of it. Just, you know, convinced them that it was not the right thing for a sports car, which was supposed to be clean, functional, you know, unadorned. It's a hard thing to protect a pure concept in a large corporation.
Everybody wants to add something.
Everybody wants to get their oar in, and but I think we just had a couple good sales on talking to them, and the car never appeared on the street with the molding, which kept it, in a sense, more of a classic than it would have been without the molding. The lack of the molding kept it far enough away from the production Fords that it really had that kind of a clean classic look, which we were striving for.
And accomplished very neatly.
Yeah, it was, as I say, a lot of these projects like this scare enough people away that you get an opportunity, you know, once in a lifetime kind of opportunity to do something without a lot of help.
Right.
Help in quotation marks.
As the original designer, what was your inspiration? Can you think back and think of what you were thinking about at the time you made these early sketches?
Oh, I think as a pilot, you know, I think probably my concept of the car was something that was relatively aerodynamic, something that wasn't taken seriously for another 25 years. Until CAFE, you know, and the oil embargoes hit us full force. But I had, when I think back, this November I will have soloed 40 years ago.
Really? You still fly?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I soloed on my birthday, on November 1st, 1944, 18th birthday.
Mm.
And I, with that background, I think my concept in the sketching of the car was simply to get a smooth aerodynamic shape, you know, that would be fuel efficient and sporty looking. of course, in my experience as kind of the head bird brain over there for about 15 years, that philosophy probably comes through. 61, 64 probably. They're a clean airfoil shape,
yeah.
Interrupted by whatever you have to have.
Mm-hmm.
Grills, bumpers, guards, lamps. But I think that kind of philosophy flowed through the thing.
So you were sort of the keeper of the flame, in a sense.
Yeah, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because what happened really was when the Carl was an instant success and the Mysterious show car had been done and introduced on the 57 Ford, I became manager of the Ford and Thunderbird studio. So really, although you didn't have a very elevated status, you did an awful lot by execution, simply because you were there. And it stayed intact because there was nobody else to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And keeper of the flame in that respect is controlled by virtue of execution of the vehicle.
You had a pretty loose atmosphere still. It was pretty fluid still at the design center in these early things.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the more rigid structures become later?
We don't, in those days, we didn't, excuse me, we didn't have the highly definitive product assumptions we have today. I think probably it was because we didn't have the research clinics and we didn't have the in-depth analysis of the markets. It was sort of a shoot from the hip kind of situation, more of an intuitive response of the planners, the marketing people, the stylists or designers. And I think probably it was looser in the sense that you didn't have the research to control the product, which gave us the opportunity really to do some rather fantastic things.
In fact, you were winging it.
We were really winging it a lot. Relying on our own inspiration, our own experience, and the world around us for inspiration, really. I mean, you know, the jet aircraft and that thing was a lot of our inspiration, led us astray to some degree, no question about it. But it provided a volatility in the market and a esprit de corps in the design and engineering areas that you find hard to come by today. Every time we go out to a research clinic, I've always maintained that they're excellent for package analysis and for features, absolutely useless for styling prognostication. It moves so quickly that 3-4 years hence that, all they do is set you back 5 years. Every time you go to a clinic, the advancement is always, it's a very retrograde step, a very frustrating thing to come back from a clinic and everybody loves what they have today because they just went and paid a big bucks for it and nobody will admit that every once in a while you get a glimmer of direction, but it handcuffs you. And I think management has shown more understanding of utilizing it in the styling sense better of late. And in some areas, like in the truck area, where people are very conservative, you do have to be very careful, you know, that you're doing a functional vehicle, and if you come out there with a toy instead of a truck, you're going to lose. So in that sense, I think, it's quite valuable.
Well, the Mystère was in some ways a precursor to that period of the Thunderbird and the
57-4. Well, we finished up the Bird in 53.
Oh, you were, your own intents and purposes, you were finished with it.
Oh yes. Yeah. See, we're completely finished with the Bird probably 2 years prior to production.
Good.
If we're not finished with it, we're late. We're holding up production, literally.
Yeah, right.
And then there was an interim period there before Thunderbird justified its own studio. Where I had the Ford Advance studio. So we really did the advance vehicles for the shows, in which I did some, and Ford Studio did some. Damon Woods and Dave Ash and I all worked on the Atmos show car, which was a double pod, bubble canopy, finned, kind of F-86 fin, which was done for the show in which the Mystère was not shown, 54, 55. I think the Mystère was probably shown in the Detroit Auto Show, and I guess that would have had to have been January 56 prior to the introduction of 57 Ford in November.
I see.
Although it was done in 54, it was held over. And it was a kind of rather wild concept with this swash molding and these pods and this rather sculptural fin and these big blast tubes coming back and this bubble canopy with a cummerbund and a snorkel for air conditioning inlets and things like that. And it had spherical instruments in pods and all sorts of things. As a matter of fact, Gail Halderman and I was the head of the studio, and Gail had come in, and Jim Quinlan was in the studio at that time.
It was the Advanced Studio.
Yeah.
So the Mysteria was one of your first projects in that.
Yeah, I'd say it was the first personal show car project that we had an opportunity to do. It was actually built, the vehicle was actually built by Creative Industries out on the east side.
Yes.
We did the clay model mold, and then we had to run back and forth to Creative to do the final vehicle because the show cars were too much workload for our poor little shops at that time. Couldn't quite handle the production work and the vehicles at the same time.
Was it a drivable prototype?
No, it was strictly fiberglass, rollable, but it wasn't drivable.
Yeah.
A couple of the cars prior to that time had been drivable.
Which ones were they?
XL500, X100, fully operational cars, but they got to be terribly expensive for, you know, show purposes, and you could evaluate the appeal of the car without having them fully operable.
These were, in effect, design laboratories in which you were allowed to go very far afield.
Yeah, you were allowed to do anything that you pleased, feasibility notwithstanding. As a matter of fact, the Mysteria had thin shell bucket seats, hard backs, you know, soft cushion, which ultimately showed up in the 64 Thunderbird. We got those thin shell seats in 64 Bird. As a matter of fact, they were originally swivel seats. And I guess there's a rendering here of myself working on a swivel seat proposal, but we never did it, and Chrysler came out with their big fin jobs. Here it is. One of those things that we didn't use, but they did. Oh, I guess that's the Atmos there. You know, many features guys will come up with in various companies, parallel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No collusion, just inspired by the same things and parallel development.
Mm-hmm.
All great minds running the same rut or something. But Chrysler came up, you know, 2 or 3 years later with that.
Yeah.
We were trying to facilitate getting in and out, entry, egress, in a very low package, because the Bird was only 52 inches high, had a very high tunnel, which we couldn't do anything about. We didn't have front-wheel drive. So we obscured it with a very neat console full of all kind of goodies and gadgets, which was, I guess that evolved out of the aircraft experience, too. You know, the consoles, the radios, and all the throttles. And so it was taking an imposition into the package of the car and creating a feature with it, you know, designing around it. But that, you know, that's form follows function. It just, you have trouble getting in and out of the car, you're trying to invent new ways of swinging out and then standing up. Or
who killed that?
I think it was just probably engineering workload and cost, and, you know, there's a limit to what you can accommodate in the programs with the people you have. And I don't think it was something, a matter of somebody personally killing it. I think it was probably as pipped out of the program. Pip meaning, you know, profit improvement, and it's gone. It can't accommodate it.
Ladies would have loved it.
Yeah, it was well received in the Chrysler vehicles.
Yeah.
And but it's one of those things that it's like the Turnpike Cruiser, you know, the Mercury with the electric memory seat and all that kind of stuff. It's like the phase we're going through now with digital readouts and electronic panels. I think the means just don't justify the ends. You know, it's too far out, too complex, too costly. There'll be a phase we go through, and once we're through the novelty of it, we'll probably revert back to a more simple presentation of data. As a matter of fact, I was got a kick out of Jackie Stewart at the Indy 500 on TV, talking about the Corvette instrument panel, the electronic panel in the Corvette, saying it was utterly bizarre. You know, it was giving you so much information all the time that the human mind couldn't cope with it. It just, you know, couldn't sort it out. It just, you know, he's an old analog, read the needles and shift at the right shift points guy. Best there ever was. I think he was a bit befuddled by all of the high tech. And we go through the same thing, you know, it's a merchandising gimmick to some degree.
Yeah.
It's probably great along on a 747 when you're out of the Pacific to punch in the buttons. Mm. If you don't punch the wrong buttons and get over Sakhalin Island,
yeah.
You know. But it has real application there. I question sometimes whether we don't go a little ape.
We don't need an onboard computer. Right.
Not yet. For emissions, yes.
So here you are in the mid-50s. The Thunderbird has been launched successfully. Of course, you've gone long beyond that. You're working in the advanced studio.
Yeah.
For whom?
I think we were probably still, I was still working for Damon at that time.
Mm-hmm. Damon Woods.
Damon Woods, yeah. Frank Hershey was still there at that time.
Mm-hmm.
I think Frank probably left in 55 sometime. Late 54, early 55.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
I think he left. My last memories of Frank are bringing a 55 Ford Crown Vic magenta and white.
Oh.
See-through roof Skyliner out into the middle of the yards, squealing the brakes and making it dip and bow.
Yeah.
And with Don Peterson saying something really, really profound, like, hot damn, you know, look at that car.
Something.
Yeah, right. So I think Frank was probably gone in mid-55, somewhere on in there. I think he was a highly independent character and ran afoul of George Walker. I don't know just, you know, what transpired.
Mm-hmm.
But
were you working with Bob McGuire at this time?
Bob McGuire was, when Frank left, Bob McGuire was head of the Ford studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe by that time, or was it in 61, that around 61, Jean Bourdonnais had become VP after the Walker era. Bob and Don Della Rosa, I think at that era, were working for Jean Bourdonnais. And then ultimately, Jean became the VP. I don't know whether I have the chronology precisely correct.
So what was engaging your main attention at this point?
56 and 57. Well, I would say that the 58 Thunderbird, where we made the transition from the two-passenger to the four-passenger, and made ourselves highly unpopular with all of the Thunderbird buffs. Very poor decision as far as the car buffs go. Highly, you know, it portended of good things for Thunderbird as far as business decision and volume goes,
yeah.
Because the Bird volume went from something like, you know, 13,000 to 15,000 or 16,000, then to 21,000 and 57.
Mm-hmm.
But the research was telling us, you know, gee, we just wish we could get a couple of kids in the back, and we looked at some 2+2 concepts, and it was decided that No would go for a full-fledged four-seater, tight, close-coupled, but full-fledged package.
This is a rather momentous decision at the time. How did it come about? You talked about product planners and...
Well, it was one of those things that some of the lower echelons wanted to do, saw the potential there for increased volume, do a four-passenger bird. Was a tremendous investment of funds and rather an unknown quantity. Engineering didn't support us. The studio went ahead and did the four-passenger bird clay model, did it to a high degree of completion without it being what they call a validated program in those days.
What's that mean?
A validated program didn't have any engineering support. There was no funding and no engineers assigned to run out the feasibility and everything. And it looked like the bird was going to die. And Bob McNamara, of all people, who was really a numbers man, super genius, came in and made a big pitch for that car and saved it, literally.
Where was this?
At the design center.
A pitch
to company management, and literally saved the car. Henry Grebe was still chief engineer at that time, and had assigned no people to it since, you know, he had no funding, no budget for that thing, and they suddenly had to scramble and assign people to it, and it became a real living program, and there was... even the package development hadn't been done. So the clay model, we literally took templates off the clay model, and it was engineered from the outside in. The package was developed, the seating was done, and it went from there. So the 58 bird was strictly a project of the Thunderbird studio per se.
That you were chief of.
Yeah, right. So we had always thought Bob McNamara was strictly a financial genius and had very little feeling for the vehicle at that time. And his selections, you know, are those things that he, it was very, 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 very conservative in his tastes. And we were all shocked, astounded, stunned, and much relieved when he came through and, you know, recommended that the program be carried on.
This sort of confrontation, or would it happen at the design center with top management there?
Yes, that would have been, you know, at the meetings in the showroom when the car was presented, and either, you know, either flew or you died, one or the other.
At this time, McNamara has succeeded Louis Crusoe, as you know, as chief of
yes,
Ford Division.
Yes, right, yeah, right.
And Crusoe's retired, I believe, with a heart problem.
Yes, correct. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the bird was dying of not enough numbers in terms
yes,
of production.
Yes, right. Well, nobody could justify it because it was an entirely new design idiom. Personal luxury didn't exist at that time. There was either the Ford Mercury, and there were convertibles, and which, you know, tended to supply the sporty market, and the small bird was thought to be a passing fad, just a hiatus, you know.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult to justify a car that, and in that price range, because at that time, you know, it was a $2,500 car,
right.
$2,000 car. It was a horrendous price.
Mm-hmm.
When things were selling for $1,600 or $1,700, so it was a very difficult thing to justify, and it took somebody of McNamara's stature, you know, a VP of General Manager Ford Division, simply to say, "Hey, you know, I I'm putting my reputation behind this, and I want to see it happen," and made it happen, very much like Lee Iacocca launched the Mustang, you know. Without Lee, you know, Mustang probably would never have happened.
McNamara, very interesting personality.
Oh yeah.
Had gotten the confidence of Henry Ford II.
Yes.
With his unique manufacturing You think, what do you think the, have you ever speculated as to why he did that? What do you think he felt that it was, would be a part of the Ford line, would enhance the Ford line?
I think so. I think that probably his vision was a little greater than the numbers crunchers, which were recommending against it, you know, and could see that, you know, that we needed this kind of a perpetuation of this kind of an advanced vehicle, or something was breaking new ground, you know. And they were trying to get the Ford out of the Tin Lizzy era, trying to appeal to the people that wanted to go upscale and yet wanted to be youthful. You know, they were trying to get Ford out. Ford had a reputation of being the blue collar workers. You know, the Mercury was the blue collar workers Buick, and it was that kind of imagery that they were trying to overcome. Still trying to overcome.
During this period of the from 52 to 56. Parallel effort was being made with the to plug the upper end of the line, which resulted in the Edsel. Were you involved in any of that activity?
No, I was strictly Ford Division up at that till that time. I didn't become involved in. I was in the Ford Division end of the styling from 52 through. Let's see. 52 through about 69, and then 69-70, I had Lincoln Mercury advanced for the first time, in which I participated in some of the work on the original Mark III and Mark IV. So, and then immediately after that, in 73, I was sent to Australia as chief designer on the Blackwood program, which was the Falcon Fairlane LTD, the Australian versions of those cars.
So what was your reaction to changing it, to the concept of changing it to a four-seater? Were you in favor of it?
I personally liked the concept. We did several vehicles. We did extended two-passenger vehicles with different themes, front and rear-end themes. The front-end theme of the two-passenger version of the 58 that we did ultimately got picked up in a modified form for the front end of the Mustang several years later.
Good stylists never throw anything away.
Oh, no, we keep all the sketches. As a matter of fact, at that time, I think Joe Orris was the chief designer, chief stylist of Ford Studio. And although I was someplace else, Joe had remembered the car, and he and Charlie Faniff and some of the other guys that worked on Mustang had gone back and picked up the photographs and the sketches of this 58 two-passenger, evolved off this 57 Bird. It translated with much modification into the Mustang front end. Basic theme was the high mouth and the low blade-like bumper was basically the theme of it, with a single headlamps outboard. The mouth was smaller and the whole package was smaller, but the essence of the components were there.
Well, the four-seater went very well in terms of.
Yeah, the four-seater in 1958, I think the volume jumped up to around 40,000, and 59 went to 50,000, and then in 1960 it went up to around 60,000. And ultimately it got up into 60 and 70 thousands there, from 61 through 64, 66. And after that, I think the last Bird I was involved with was a 70 or 71, and then it made a change. It began coming off the big Mark body, which was evolved from the Torino, and it became a much bigger car. There was an era there where the the Mark and the Thunderbird was really the four divisions version of the Mark. And in a way, it was a successful car. In a way, we handed the Thunderbird market to Chevrolet with their Monte Carlo. We walked out of that segment of the market, and they jumped in there. They had never been able to do anything with that would offset the Thunderbird. And that was their opportunity. They jumped in with the Monte Carlo and were very successful with that.
Now again, how did you happen to hand that to them? What was the evolution?
Well, I think the Mark became very successful for Lincoln Mercury. The premium name in Ford division was Thunderbird. So they wanted a Mark kind of car in size and ambiance. And in that sense, they started taking the bird off the bigger body. And instead of, it was more commodious, a much bigger car in terms of interior accommodations. And it got away from the very close coupled, clubby, personal luxury car it had been previously. And it evolved into a bigger machine. And that left a gaping hole in the market there. And Monte Carlo, you know, Chevrolet took advantage of it. At least in my mind, that's the way it happened.
They did very well with that.
Oh, yeah. And then I think we recognized that, and we came back with a modification of the Torino, the Elite, you know,
yes.
Ford Elite, which John Naughton elected not to schedule very many of because he didn't like it and was dismissed. That was a blunder, I think, on our part, you know.
Good concept.
Yeah.
How do some of those decisions get made? Would it be the product planners decide that they've got a market hole to fill, and they say to the designers, "Look, we've got to do something we've got to make this more palatable to a larger or wider audience."
Yes, I think probably those things get decided with top management of them. Planning, marketing, design, and financial hierarchies, and the design subcommittees, the product planning committees, on which all the top executives sit.
At this time in the mid to late 50s, you're still outside of the mainstream of decision making in this process, are you?
Yes, I was in 1961. I became design executive for the Ford Thunderbird, and at that time Gene was the vice president. So really, those things were handled at the vice presidential level.
Gene Bordenay.
Yeah. So Gene Bordenay was involved in those corporate kinds of decisions. As designers, we were strictly in the background. I mean, maybe we were there in the showroom to support.
Yes.
Putting things on and off the car or change proposals, but we weren't actively involved in the corporate management. I really didn't get involved in any of that until I went to Ford Australia as chief designer, where you were a bigger fish in a littler pond, you know.
Yeah, you were able to influence certain corporate decisions. Mm-hmm.
Brian Engels was a managing director in Australia.
Uh-huh.
Tremendous guy to work for, Sir Brian Engels.
Uh-huh.
He was... a guy that really, you know, respected the designer and said, "Hey, you know, if that's the way you think it ought to be, fine, we'll do it. But if it doesn't come out right, put your tin pants on, you know, and get ready for the onslaught."
Right.
He had the ability to delegate, you know, the authority and decision making down, and terrific guy. I enjoyed working for Brian. Tremendously.
So after the two-seater Thunderbird, which went very well for a time, what sort of activities were you involved with?
Well, we did, at that time, Ford and Thunderbird Studio were combined. So there was a whole series of Thunderbirds and Fords that evolved. I guess Thunderbird, the next move was to put the Thunderbird front end in some of its rear end cues onto the 58 Ford, because that was the whole reason for being of the Bird, was to inspire and elevate the prestige of the production vehicles.
There was a lot of that going on.
And something that was carried forward and began to influence the whole industry was the blind quarter roof, which evolved out of the little two-passenger vehicle that we had done, and we put a roof on there that was a removable hardtop, simply you know, to make it more of an all-weather car and not so much of a sports car. And when we did that, Mr. Crusoe couldn't see coming from Silvery Lane onto Outer Drive that oblique 45 degree rear view, so we put portholes in there.
Is that how that evolved?
That evolved was Mr. Crusoe complaining about not being able to see with that rear oblique approach, and so we came up with the portholes as a solution, and we came up with that by going back through a lot of old coaches and things, you know, English coaches, Victorian coaches,
yes. Uh-huh.
Funny names like the Booby Hatch and
yes.
the Londo and all those old names, and said, hey, you know, the porthole wouldn't be a bad job, and so, and that in turn influenced the later Marks with their oval windows in the quarters, you know, for the same reason.
But yours was the first.
Yeah, the porthole and the bird roof was really the first, which was really a functional requirement, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The boss didn't like it, and
he didn't want to spin in coming into work.
Do something, do something or else.
That's fascinating.
And the blind quarter roof got interpreted then because of its very structural look and its closed, clubby look on the 58 bird,
mm-hmm.
got associated with prestige, you know, and. We picked it up on the Ford Galaxy in order to enhance the upscale, you know, take me to the theater type of very formal roof to give the get rid of the Tin Lizzie
succeeded very
connotations
well.
And you know, lift the car up into a more formal, more of a Lincoln, or I should say really Cadillac ambiance at that time. So, you know, one thing led to the other, and the cues that were developed in the bird got translated throughout the car lines.
The Thunderbird effect was very beneficial to Ford merchandising in that era, into the 60s.
Oh, yeah, they had the Thunderbird V8 Y-block engines and all sorts of, you know,
yes.
and the nice... rocker covers, chrome-plated rocker covers, and the turquoise bird western, you know, the turquoise Thunderbird western motif from the Navajos and the what are the other Indian tribes that do the nice silver work out in the southwest. The I guess the Hopis do the nice silver work.
Yeah.
So we were taking our cues, you know,
sure.
wherever we could find them.
Contemporary artifacts,
mm-hmm.
traditions. But where that leaves you in the early 60s then, what are you thinking about at this time? Are you, what sort of assignments are coming your way at this point?
In the early 60s, we would have been working on the mid-60s vehicles,
mm-hmm.
which would have been the last birds prior to the introduction of the large bodies where they tried to simulate the Mark Mark IV market for the Ford Division, where I was sent to Australia and got off on the Lincoln Mercury vehicles.
You parted company there?
Yeah, I parted company. I didn't get back to working on birds, let's say, in 75, where the bird became a very high-volume car. Gale worked pretty much that because I had left for Australia, and then when I came back from Australia, I was made director of I can't even remember the studio's name, but ultimately I became director of luxury and intermediate, and the 83 bird Cougar was the last one I worked on.
Can you describe the Australian experience, how it came about and how you enjoyed it?
Yeah, all right.
Why it came about?
Well, they were looking for people that would were willing to, you know, pick up lock, stock, and barrel and go to Australia, somebody who had sufficient experience to be chief designer, because they were anticipating effort on an all-new car. And about that, they had asked me to go to England and Germany previously, but my kids at that time were in the latter stages of high school and college, and it was just not possible. And when the request came for the Australian assignment, my youngest daughter was in between in her last 2 years of college and was more than willing to go with us. My older daughter was just finished a master's degree at the University of Michigan, and my son was in the Navy. So Australia looked pretty good, you know, after this was 1973, so I had been at Ford like 20 years. Mm-hmm. So it was a good time to make a break and get a new perspective on things. So went down there and spent 3 years as chief designer, mm-hmm. which is a tremendous experience.
It must have been.
It was a new thing to us. Mm-hmm. Enjoyed the people tremendously. Mm-hmm. And didn't enjoy much the tax situation and everything, but it was a real education. Uh-huh. Well, I went down there and as a visiting industrial expert, mm-hmm. With 70% of my salary paid out to me down there, and 30% withheld back here for, you know, the various things you're into, and you cover your insurance costs and things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. But I was going to be taxed at U.S. rates down there, and I was down there 10 months, and the labor government, which came into power in Australia, rescinded all the conventions with the U.S. on VIEs, visiting industrial experts, and suddenly I was being taxed on 100% of my U.S. salary at a 66% rate, being withheld from my salary. So I ended up with a subsistence allowance down there to live on. It was, I think, exactly half of my take-home pay was committed to renting the house that I had rented down there, and the rest of it was for food, and that was it.
Yeah.
So in that respect, it was a little bit of a trying experience, but as far as the business experience and the opportunity to travel, just you know, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, really great.
You had... previous to this, you had been working on fairly large automobiles as the design executive of the Lincoln.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So, and you'd come out with some, worked on some pretty interesting models there.
Yeah, the original Marks, and that was a kind of a fun time too. That was the first time I'd had a chance to work on prestige cars, you know, other than Thunderbird.
Right.
And it was a interesting experience, but it was good because most of the cars in Australia at that time were large cars.
Oh, were they?
Yes. The Australian Falcon had evolved into a 111-inch wheelbase, 60-inch tread Tiger of a car. A Cleveland 351 V8, 11-to-1 compression, and it went like a scalded aardvark, you know. It was a brutal car for a brutal country. It was a car that today they are continuing. They are not picking up European Scorpio nor the Ford, the Taurus.
Really?
They are reworking their own car. The conditions are sufficiently rugged in the outback of that country. That the original Falcons had just pounded the suspension to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Very poor reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, that was in 62. By, let's see, the Blackwood I worked on was the car that took over market leadership from GM in Australia. In 1981, we were working on this car, and I came back in 76. And they just gradually built that car up into something that was so durable and had such good quality that ultimately achieved market leadership from a little imported or locally built, but imported in the engineering sense from the U.S., where the highways are so good that, you know, you can get away with much lighter components. And over that span of years from, say, 62 to 72, that 10, 12-year period, they came up in percentages from 7 to 9 to 13 to 17% and up to around 22-23% of the market. Gained leadership from GM, and the rest of the market was pretty much Japanese, European.
The what was the design setup there at in Australia when you were there?
Very much the same as here.
Was it pretty much it imported the
The bridges that we used? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just like being at home as far as. There were subtle differences. We didn't have the work done on the scale that we have here. It was like a 60-minute football team. The designers and the modelers literally worked on the cars and went from modeling into the plaster shop and into the fiberglass, and all the same people following it through. And then all the same people were moving the cars and then taking them down to the exhibition halls in Melbourne for clinics and research. And, you know, it was a little team that was very effective, very tight-knit group.
Was it a Geelong then, or was it?
It originally started out in 1925 on Corio Bay. The two plants were in Geelong. Geelong was the...
When I say Geelong, I mean Geelong.
Geelong.
Yeah, right.
Where they assembled the Model Ts.
Right.
Those plants ultimately became the product engineering area where Eric Lang held forth as the chief engineer.
Uh-huh.
And then during Jack's Telmac's era down there in the 60s, mid-60s, they built this new design center. And then Duncan McRae was chief designer, and then I followed Duncan as the chief designer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I inherited a beautiful little design center.
Oh. Sort of a miniature Dearborn.
Yeah, really. It was just a miniature version of it.
Mm-hmm.
And very nice facilities.
That was Telnak, some of Telnak's inspiration.
Jack Telnak kicked it off, yeah. He provided the impetus for it and moved out of Geelong, never got an opportunity really to see the see the fruition of his works, but
you probably had a dual personality there in the sense that you were designing for the cities and the